Marking March 1st, Independence Movement Day here in Korea, we've invited a very special guest to shed light on the past, present, and future of Korea-Japan relations. To help us navigate the complex historical issues between the two countries from a third-party point of view, Alexis Dudden, professor of history at the University of Connecticut and an acclaimed East Asia historian, now joins us via Zoom. Good morning from Seoul, and thank you for joining us.
Morning and happy Independence Day.
Happy Independence Day. What a special occasion to have you connect with us. We appreciate it. You're one of the most well-known American historians on Korea for your efforts, particularly in establishing accurate historical views on a number of deeply seated Korean-Japanese feuds. But maybe we can begin today's interview with a pretty basic question on your pursuits. What motivated you to study so deeply and specifically the history of Korea and Japan and become deeply engaged in sharing your views with the world?
Pure chance, the point of education. In high school, I won a scholarship to go to several months in Tokyo. And I learned that French and Latin did not help with Japanese. And so I learned how to make friends in my classroom through drawing and swim competitions. And I actually already knew the math we were doing, and I'm not known for my mathematical skills, but I'm like, okay, I could do that too. But these were the languages with which I spoke to my classmates. And so it was pure chance. And then it became life.
The rest is history.
I still don't know what I want to do when I grow up.
That's fascinating. Maybe something to unpack a later time because we have so much grounds to cover this morning. But maybe for our listeners' better understanding, we can take a look at a career milestone for you. Back in 2015, you led 187 historians from around the world to issue a statement opposing the former Abe administration's distortion of history, for which you were awarded the Manhae Peace Prize. It turns out it's a rare feat achieved by Western scholars. Can you maybe take us back to the lead up to the Manhae Peace Prize, and what did the issued statement say?
So it remains the most humbling event. People such as Shirin Ebadi from Iran, who does astonishing, she's won a Nobel Peace Prize. And this woman has won the same prize for work with refugees and children in conflict zones. So I never believe I deserve this honor. And I look at who Manhae, the pen name of Han Yong-un, is, a signatory to the 1919 Declaration of Independence, which I think listeners and everyone from around the world should know, the Korea Declaration of Independence is not anti-Japanese. It actually, today's a really good day to reread Korea's Declaration of Independence, which is, yes, based on an American Declaration of Independence. Yet in Korea's, it says we should look at Japan because we need guidance. We don't need to be oppressed. We don't need to be terrorized, which was what was happening in 1919. And historically speaking, comparisons are odious in the sense that everybody who suffers differently. Korea suffered intensely in the 1910s. In a way that the world ignored because World War I was on in Europe. And the signatories, the movement in Korea, sought to give voice to the oppression that was happening in Korea, and it did not signal Japan, it signaled oppression, and it wanted independence. And so that's where Manhae becomes a voice of inspiration. And so, you know, that I don't feel I deserve this. The lead up to it was the government of Japan denied that military sex slavery happened. And my colleagues from around the world, initially it was 20 of us at one meeting. Then it's 187 people. Then it was 400 people. And then because my colleagues and I were historians, we don't know how to use the internet. And so we just had to cap it. Because otherwise, there would be tens, hundreds of thousands of people that would have signed.
Mm-hmm. Professor Dudden, 2015 is already almost 10 years ago. And in this discussion of the Japanese government coming closer to issuing an apology, which is what the victims of sexual slavery and forced labor want, I'm not quite sure if we've made progress.
I know. And this is so interesting. This week, I've been at several venues. Columbia Law School hosted a venue, and then a number of places around the world, internet conversations about progress. For listeners who may not have been born, the 1990s was a moment of hope. Mm-hmm. And it was lost. And it was lost in the wake of a new reorganization. And so when we say we haven't made progress, we have. Because when Kim Hak-sun, the first person to come forward, who happened to be Korean, she came forward in 1991 and put her name on the crime that had happened to her body. Thousands of victims have come forward to say, this happened to me. And we connect it to similar things that by 1998, by the United Nations, had been described as a crime against humanity. Mm. So we have made progress, but progress when we're talking about human rights and victims is difficult. And we look at world conditions today.
Because now we're talking about compensations and government-level apologies, and that's where it gets a little bit thorny and complex, even more complex than before. Can we also discuss the 1965 treaty? You've mentioned in previous interviews that the U.S. is partly responsible for the ongoing conflicts between Korea and Japan. You elaborated that the 1965 Seoul-Tokyo Treaty, which Japan argues has settled all claims issues between the two countries, was brokered by the U.S., which largely sided with Japan at the time. Can you elaborate on that point?
Sure. Two points are really important. In 1965, human rights law did not yet exist. So the possibility of a survivor of what the United Nations in 1998 described as a crime against humanity did not exist. Now we are today. That exists. But let's go back to 1965, the United States was already interested in a different conflict in Asia, because the view of containing communism, which is understandable from an American-centric world, from a Western-centric perspective, from even today, had shifted south to Vietnam, and it becomes a budget decision. Mm. And so the United States wanted to shift its budget from the Republic of Korea to South Vietnam, and then decided negotiations between Japan and South Korean officials had been going on for, sorry, I can't do math in public, between 1952 and 1964. And so discussions had been going on. Yet American officials decided, okay, Japan, it's your turn to pay. We're going to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And so overnight, Japan had to make an agreement. Mm.
So it was almost rushed.
It was incredibly rushed. And that's where the language that we use in today's terminology was brought in by the then American ambassador to Japan, Edwin Reischauer, of sorrow and regret, rather than a full state-sponsored backed apology.
Japan just last week also reignited territorial feud over Korea-controlled Dokdo Islets, holding the annual Takeshima Day event and renewing its false claims. What exactly happened after World War II regarding the demarcation of Dokdo?
Such an excellent question, and I'm a professor, so forgive me, exactly will be impossible to answer because I have spent decades. So there, I don't know. I do know what happened. I do know the documents, as many scholars do, that lead up to the final treaty, which puts it out the window. And so when I say it that way, there were many discussions, but please, for listeners to bear in mind, Dokdo was not what Japan was asking for. Japan was asking for Jeju-do. Japan was asking for Taiwan. Japan was asking for Okinawa back. Okinawa doesn't come back to Japan until 1972. Japan was asking for the still disputed islands with Russia, let alone the islands disputed with China and Taiwan. Japan was also asking for parts of Korea, including Ulleung-do, not in addition to Jeju-do. So Dokdo is like the least of their worries until the very end.
Ah.
And at the same time for Koreans, and understandably, Dokdo is the first piece of territory that Japan takes. And so understandably, and forgive my pronunciation, Korean is really difficult, but Dokdo nun uritang imnida is, you know, this is like, no Korean's going to give that up. And I don't mean to sound racist about this, but we can negotiate about people and interpretations of history, but there's a reason that Syngman Rhee put forces on Dokdo.
Then this is probably the more complex part of the question too. Then how should Korea and Japan address the issue going forward? Because we've gone back and forth when the pendulum swings from the conservative to the liberal government. Our approaches may seem different, how we negotiate with Japan, but nothing has really changed in a larger context.
Exactly. And I appreciate the way you frame this. I mean, President Imran Bak is the only president who has set foot. I mean, like, he's the one who landed. So this is not liberal conservative. This is Korean territory. And so moving forward, Japan should just give it up. That, I mean, seriously, there are thousands of articles about this. It is not, it was Japanese territory, legally speaking, from 1905 to 1945, as was the entirety of the Korean Peninsula.
Do you think Japan can also hyper-politicize this issue too, and that makes it difficult for them to, well, look at the historical facts, look at these same articles and research paper and draw an entirely different conclusion, or even set it aside?
Absolutely, and forgive me for interrupting. Yes, because this is part of a Japanese strategy moving forward to expand to the greatness that Japan can achieve. And this conflicts with history and contemporary international law of the oceans. And so it's this disjunct because there are so many opportunities for Korean and Japanese cooperation involving this territory, especially about joint resource exploration, joint understanding. The fact that in 2005, even North Korea issued stamps. You know, this was in 2005, North Korea said it would send its navy to defend Dokdo for Korea. This is space for cooperation in the region. And yet, if you look back several years, this is also where Russia and China know that they can, like, see who's testing whom. And that's why the flyovers happen, because the space above this territory remains up for grabs, and that is part of the United States is doing. And so it's up to the United States to say, hey, you know, guys, let's just dial this back.
Professor Dutton, because we're so limited on time, I think I need the whole hour to continue on. Maybe we can combine question 5 and 6. So we've talked about it in our headlines before, a bereaved family of a Korean victim, a wartime forced laborer, withdrew roughly $44,800 from a collateral deposited by Hitachi Zosen at the Seoul court, to which the Japanese government said is extremely regrettable. What is your take on this? And then, of course, what are your thoughts on the Korean government's new and fresh approach to compensate victims of wartime forced labor through third-party funds?
Sure. So third-party funds, if it helps the family immediately in terms of health benefits, if they don't have access to healthcare, yes, help the families. And that can be privately negotiated. But ultimately, this has to come from the Japanese corporations, the state-sponsored Japanese corporations, Hitachi, Mitsubishi, Mitsui, that sponsored these 700 to 800,000 Koreans that were forced to labor. And, this is part of the San Francisco Treaty. Japan ought to pay.
And our final question today. A few years ago, a professor of Harvard Law, Mark Ramsayer, argued that Korean victims of Japan's wartime sexual slavery were, quote, willing prostitutes. Backlash quickly ensued. Your tough criticism towards him, calling his article a poorly resourced, evidently fatuous piece of scholarly production, it did help to an extent console the outraged Korean public. The big question probably is, in your view, what more needs to be done to resolve the decades-old conflict over Japan's wartime sexual slavery?
Twofold. There's no debate. It's facts versus denialism, and one party is simply Holocaust denialists. There is so much evidence that what happened beginning inside Japan, extending then to the Korean Peninsula, to China, to the Philippines, to Indonesia, to Australia, this happened. And we need to not think about sex slavery as a Korea-Japan issue, empire-wide, and we need to reframe this as among the 20th century's, if not the 20th century's largest example of state-sponsored trafficking of minors for the purposes of rape. It's not a question of anything else. And we see this happening today in Ukraine. Why Vladimir Putin has been accused of being a war criminal is because of the trafficking of minors across borders. That's what happened. And so what Japan, which is the country is an amazingly positive member of the international community, and it contributes except on these issues of the past. And that's a particular political view inside Japan. And it needs to own up to what happened inside Japan for the world to move forward positively.
Professor Dudden, thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you so much for including me.
If you're listening to our program using the podcast service, just a reminder that we do go live Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. Korea Standard Time. So tune in and help us make the show more informative by giving us your input. See you bright and early on Good Morning Seoul.